listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, the Supreme Court, the other shoe dropped. This McCutcheon versus the FEC is sort of the other half of Citizens United. The Citizens United had left intact what are called aggregate campaign limits or contribution limits that you can give money to politicians directly to their campaigns, and there are limits on that amount, and those are left intact in McCutcheon. But in aggregate, you can't give more than roughly $123,000. I think it was $123,200. If you were rich enough, like the Koch brothers, they made over $10 billion last year, or over the last decade. If you were to just simply say, I'm going to give the maximum limit, or I'm just going to buy every politician in America, you can't do that. There's an aggregate limit of $123,000 and change. And the Supreme Court struck that down, and that announcement came out today. The lawyer for Sean McCutcheon, and a Republican activist and Alabama-based engineer, the lead attorney in this case, arguing before the United States Supreme Court, was a fellow by the name of Dan Backer. He is the founder and principal attorney with DB Capital Strategies. The website is dbcapitalalstrategies.com. And Dan is on the line with us. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. I just want to make two quick corrections.
Please.
One is the website actually works with either it's T-A-L or T-O-L. We have a weird technical thing we're trying to fix. And I actually didn't argue the case in front of the Supreme Court. We had the very capable Erin Murphy, who used to clerk for Justice Roberts. We were able to get her to be our oral advocate. And as somebody who knew the mind of the Chief Justice, it was a phenomenal opportunity, and so she argued the case for Mr. McCutcheon and the RNC.
Oh, that sounds like a very, very good strategy. You were the lead attorney, however, though. You helped put together the arguments.
Yes, I like to say that I'm probably not the architect of the case, but I am the general contractor. I've been Sean's political counsel since before the case was a prize, and he and I've been through the FEC, the district court, and ultimately the Supreme Court.
Right. So in the dissent, this was a 5-4 decision, and in the dissent, they didn't even refer to the majority, which says to me that there's really some bad blood forming here between the five conservative justices and the four more liberal justices. In the dissent, they said, in making this argument, the plurality relies heavily upon a narrow definition of corruption that excludes efforts to obtain influence over or access to elected officials or political parties. In other words, the argument that Justices Roberts, Kennedy, Alito, Thomas, and who am I missing, Scalia, made was that just because you give a lot of money to a politician and just because that causes them to give you access to them, that's not necessarily corruption. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I believe that's a fair way of putting it.
Okay, so how is that not corruption?
Because the Supreme Court has defined the only justification for interfering with political speech as quid pro quo corruption. It's not corruption as some general nebulous concept. It's a very specific form of corruption.
No, I understand that.
You're giving me something in your official duties.
No, I understand that, Dan. The Supreme Court has also said in Dred Scott that people are property. I mean, the Supreme Court has said a lot of things over the years that when we look back on, we say those guys were fools. I would argue even that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided, that they were basically making law rather than deciding law. This is judicial activism and judicial review on steroids. But just for practical purposes, and there's countries all over the world that struggle with this. You know, in the UK, for example, there's a £100,000 limit on how much money can be spent on a campaign. So campaigns typically don't run more than about 4 weeks. Other countries do it in other ways. But most developed democracies have some way of keeping billionaires and multinational corporations, or in our case, you know, for example, the Bin Laden family, from buying politicians. And the Supreme Court seems to have knocked out all of those limitations.
That's simply not the case. Okay. Right on its face. Foreign donors may not contribute to American political activity in any way, shape, or form.
It's already happened. It's happening constantly. They set up American subsidiaries and they make large donations. It happened in the last election.
Corporations cannot make contributions directly to candidates either. Only
they do it through PACs, which again, a loophole that was opened by this Supreme Court.
Do you want to answer your question or not? I'm going to give you the answer that you obviously don't want to hear, but I'm giving you the answer. Corporations may not legally contribute. Corporations may raise money from their restricted class employees, which is a very narrow universe of individuals in any given corporation or a union membership or trade association membership. They can raise money from those people and contribute those hard dollars. But that is not the same as saying, well, you know, GE just cut me a check for $50,000 or for $50,000. There's a limitation on the amount that may come from the PAC to any of those candidates. And there's a limitation that can go into that PAC from a very narrow universe. Now, it's really easy to just go and say, well, I don't care. I don't like it because it doesn't look right to me. But there's a fundamental difference here. My right to free speech, your right to free speech and free assembly is intrinsic to you. It is your right. And the government doesn't give it to you. You have it to begin with. And so when the government comes in and tries to regulate around that right, as it may do, it must do so in the narrowest, most carefully constructed means possible.
And to so protect the public welfare, and to protect the public welfare, or as Justice Stevens said,
to protect the public welfare. That is not a ground that the Supreme Court has recognized to limit your constitutional right to speech and assembly. Put it this way: you have a radio show; you're allowed to get on the air and say whatever you want. But what if
I'm not?
The government came in and the government limits your use of certain profanity and penalized for it. What if the government came in and sat in your newsroom and said, you know, you're not doing enough stories about this topic. You need to do this or we're going to revoke your license.
That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is whether money is protected in the First Amendment, because that's the core of this thing. That was the core of Buckley. And arguably this decision even knocked down Buckley. But that was the core of Buckley.
This decision clearly says on its face over and over again, we are maintaining the Buckley standard.
No, they said that they said that we don't actually twice. They said we don't need the Buckley standard in particular examples. I mean, but even if they're maintaining the Buckley standard, the Buckley standard was still asserting that money was protected within boundaries by the First Amendment as speech. And I'm suggesting that is fallacious, that on its face is wrong.
And
Why should Sean McCutcheon, because he's a multimillionaire, have more speech than me?
Why should Sean McCutcheon, because he's a multimillionaire, have some of his rights denied to him because you don't have the same
rights? Well, you're saying that it's a right. I'm not saying that it's a right to spend money.
Yes, it is. It is a right to contribute to political candidates.
Well, it is according to the Supreme Court. But why?
It's according to the Supreme Court 40 years ago in Buckley v. Valeo. It's according to every single Supreme Court ruling that touched on this. There's a constitutional right to speech and association, and money is the only practical means by which individuals may speak and potentially speak and associate. It is absolutely your right to do so. And even, with all due respect, even the dissent is not saying you don't have a right to make contributions. What they're arguing is, what the dissent has argued, is that contributions are subject to some different standard of corruption than has been the settled law for at least the last several years, and frankly goes back to Buckley v. Valeo.
Well, no, I understand that, and in fact, I would refer you to Stevens's dissent in Citizens United, where he said, you know, the most corrupting influence on our democracy of this is going to be that people are going to assume that everybody's bought off, and they're not going to participate in the democratic process.
The most corrupting influence in our democracy is government that is overregulating and encouraging people to participate in ways that you apparently don't like. But, you know, I get that you don't like this ruling, but it's still perfectly in accordance with the law.
Well, and Dan, you won the case. So, you know, congratulations on that. Dan Backer, dbcapitalstrategies.com. Thanks, Dan, for dropping by.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what possible alternative could there be if the Supreme Court asserts positively that money is protected by the First Amendment? Welcome back. Andrew Campbell, our senior producer, is on the line with us for The Big Picture on 7 o'clock tonight, Eastern Time, on Free Speech TV. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom.
So I was just debating with Dan Backer, who is the lead attorney for McCutcheon, the case that was just decided before the Supreme Court, and I guess you could say that we agreed to disagree. We're going to be talking with Congressman DeFazio about this tonight.
Yeah, we'll be talking to the congressman a little bit more about the McCutcheon decision and its ramifications for elections in America, especially leading up to the 2014 midterms. This could have some pretty immediate effects on the amount of money that's being thrown around in politics. So we'll be talking to the congressman about that. Mm-hmm. And we'll also be touching on the continued Republican refusal to extend long-term unemployment benefits. The talking point out of Republicans lately has been that an extension won't do anything to help create jobs in America, but that's simply not the case. A recent CBO, Congressional Budget Office, report showed that a one-year extension of long-term unemployment will provide 200,000 new jobs to the economy. So it looks like a little willful ignorance on the part of the Republicans, so we'll be getting the congressman's take on that.
Gee, Republicans? Willful ignorance? Who would have thought?
Exactly.
Okay, and then we're going to have our Lone Liberal Rumble with Adam Beitley and Dan Bongino, who, by the way, is running for Congress from Maryland's 6th District.
Yep, should be a good rumble. We'll be touching a little bit more about the McCutcheon decision. We'll also talk about the hypocrisy that is the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court case, and really talking about how it's just another example of billionaires controlling the system. We'll move from there to talk a little bit more about Obamacare. 7.1 million people signed up for Obamacare. The numbers were released yesterday. So it looks like this really has been a success story, but obviously I don't think Adam and Dan are going to agree, so we'll get their take on that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll finish up talking about the U.S. government's warrantless searches of Americans. It's pretty scary stuff, but they're getting at. So we'll be getting what Dan and Adam's take on that as well.
All right. I have not yet seen the Cesar Chavez documentary, and I'm very much looking forward to it. Louise and I are going to try and do it one night this week, or if not this weekend. I'm guessing you haven't seen it yet either.
I have not seen it either, but from what the reviews are saying, it's pretty impactful and very moving stuff, so it should be a great film.
Yeah, so tonight Arturo Rodriguez, who's the president of the United Farm Workers Union, the union that Cesar Chavez, if he didn't begin it, he certainly popularized it, made it famous, is going to be on with us.
Yeah, Chavez certainly built the foundation for the UFW, and we'll be getting Arturo's take on the Chavez legacy, especially with this new movie coming out, and really talk about what he did and the impacts that he had on the world and on immigration issues, and it should be an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Before Chavez, we'd had the Bracero program. That, we tried a whole bunch of different weird things to basically have our cake and eat it too. And our Daily Take, Charles Keating is dead.
Yeah, we're basically going to be talking in the Daily Take about how doing a comparison between the Reagan and Bush administration's response to the savings and loan crisis and compare that to the Obama administration's response to the 2008 financial crisis. Certainly an interesting juxtaposition. Should be a good Daily Take.
Yeah, with the exception of Neil Bush, who was up to his eyeballs in the Silverado savings and loans, with the exception of him, a whole bunch, you know, Reagan prosecuted over 1,000 people, and a bunch of them went to jail, including Charles Keating, who just died today at the age of 90. So we will get into that. Andrew Campbell, thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Supreme Court just basically legalized money laundering by rich campaign donors, as Ian Millhiser says over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. And, you know, I was sort of hoping that I could have a conversation with Dan Backer about if we're not going to stop corruption of our political process by rich people by virtue of regulating money, then how do we do it? But I never really got an opportunity to ask that question, and I think that his answers to every question that led up to that indicated that he didn't have an answer to that question, although he's not here to speak for himself, so I don't know. Maybe he does. But it's looking at the arguments that are made, and by the way, he is right. That was just absolutely brilliant to get John Roberts' clerk to argue the case. You know, a young woman at that because you've got now three female justices on the court, although her arguments were not persuasive to the women on the court. But it just, you know, slick stuff. And they, you know, they're very proud of themselves. And America is now becoming a plutocracy. This, to me, says so clearly that we all need to be doing two things. One, supporting candidates whose first and foremost commitment is to get money out of politics. The only one that I know of right now who is overtly supporting the Move to Amend effort, which is all corporations are not covered by the, no corporations are covered by the 14th Amendment, no money is covered by the First Amendment, is Marianne Williamson. She's running for Henry Waxman's old seat out in Los Angeles. And MarianneForCongress.com, I think, is her website. And, you know, we need to be supporting candidates like that. And number two, we need to be part of a citizens' action movement to say, okay, if the Supreme Court is going to say, as they, I mean, you know, over the years, back in the 1870s, there was a woman by the name of Sarah Bradwell who passed the bar in Chicago and walked into a courtroom one day and said, I'm a lawyer, I've passed the bar, got my license, and I'm here to argue on behalf of my defendant, Joe Blow, or whoever it was. And the judge looked down at her and said, you are a woman. You may not argue in my courtroom. And Ms. Bradwell said, I don't think so. I mean, that's not, you can't do that. And the judge said, I just did. You're out. So she sued. It was Bradwell versus Illinois, as I recall. So it must have been a state court. And she took this all the way to the Supreme Court. And I don't have a copy of Unequal Protection. Can somebody toss me that right there? It's right in front of the clock. Because I have to read this language to you. It is so mind-boggling. And this is just an example of how wrong, Shano, thank you so much, how wrong the Supreme Court can get things. I mean, look this up in my own book, right? Bradwell, B-R-A-D. Bradwell v. Illinois, page 53 and page 320. Let's see if page 53 has it. Here it is. The Supreme Court in 1873 in Bradwell v. Illinois, Justice Joseph P. Bradley wrote the opinion for the court, and he said, and I quote, basically he said to her, no, you can't be a lawyer, or you have no right to be a lawyer. He said, and I quote, the family institution is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband. So firmly fixed was this sentiment in the founders of the common law that it became a maxim of that system of jurisprudence that a woman has no legal existence separate from her husband, who is regarded as her head and representative in the social state. That was 1873. The Supreme Court said women have no rights outside of those provided to them by their husbands. In fact, they couldn't execute a will. They couldn't sign a contract. They couldn't own things. If their husband died, a man was named as the executor of their estate, and he took a third of the estate for doing the job. And he could decide what happened to her children. She could lose her children. Women had no rights. And so how did we get around that? In 1920, we all got together and said, screw this. We're going to overturn the Supreme Court's Bradwell v. Illinois and other decisions like it, and we're going to assert that women have equal rights with men, they have, including the right to vote. And that was the 19th Amendment passed in 1920 or the 20th Amendment passed in 1919? I get them mixed up, but it's one or the other. I'm pretty sure it's the 19th Amendment passed in 1920. Actually, I have a constitution here. I can look it up. But the point of the matter is that the way you get around a bad Supreme Court decision is by amending the Constitution. The Supreme Court in 1856 in Dred Scott ruled that people are property. It's slavery is totally just fine, thank you very much. We fought the Civil War, but that was still the law. So how did we overcome a bad Supreme Court decision? We did it by passing the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The 13th Amendment explicitly outlaws slavery. The 14th Amendment explicitly says you have equal protection under the law regardless of your race and regardless of your position, previous position of involuntary servitude. In other words, if you were a slave. And the 15th Amendment says you have the right to vote if you were a slave. If I'm recalling correctly. Yes. Thank you. Shane is nodding. He's our expert in all things constitutional. So, I mean, this is, okay, here's the, that's suffrage in the District of Columbia is the 23rd Amendment. Yeah, it's the 19th Amendment passed in 1920. There we go. Interesting. When was this thing proposed? Yep, it was proposed on June 4th, 1919, ratified August 18th, 1920.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we have no shortage of examples of when the people have gotten together and said, we're going to pass a constitutional amendment to undo some idiot thing that the Supreme Court did. We need to do it again. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Stephen Ally is with us. Am I pronouncing it? Is it Ally or Ally? It's Ally.
Ally.
Ally. Hey, Stephen. You are the vice president of the Timothy Plan, timothyplan.com, and this having apropos of the Hobby Lobby case, we were just speaking with Dan Backer, who was the lead attorney for McCutcheon. That was an interesting conversation. Tell us about Timothy Plan.
Well, Tom, it's great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, first I'd like to say that the Timothy Plan supports and we love Hobby Lobby. What the Timothy Plan is, Tom, is we are a family of mutual funds, and we're not unlike any other mutual fund that people can invest in, except for the fact that we look a little deeper and try to avoid companies that are involved in issues like pornography or abortion to give investors that are concerned about where their money's being invested, the ability to match their investment decisions with their moral convictions.
I'm assuming this is associated with a quote from one of Timothy's letters in the New Testament.
This is true. Timothy 5:8 and 5:22. The first one being providing for your family, and the second 22 would be avoiding evil.
Interesting. So you're essentially a you know, when typically when people think of socially responsible or socially conscious funds, they think of funds that don't invest in oil companies or don't invest in meatpacking plants or don't invest in despoiling the earth, which are kind of more liberal values. You're a socially conscious or socially responsible or religiously responsible investment vehicle, fund of investment funds for religious conservatives.
That is correct.
Okay.
Socially responsible is how we like to.
Yeah, socially responsible. Great. For Christian, actually, Christian, specifically Christian conservatives, I would
assume. Morally conservative Christians,
right.
You know, it doesn't matter if you're pro-life or pro-family and you care about where your money's being invested, we're an investment option for you.
Just out of curiosity, how did you perform last year?
We did quite well, actually. We're going to rank right up there with the big boys.
That's great.
It depends on your money management team, but we really only eliminate 6 to 7% of the universe because of decisions made at a corporate board level.
So would you eliminate, I get it that you would eliminate a pharmaceutical company that makes RU486, you know, the abortion,
correct.
Abortion
pill,
basically.
This
you would probably eliminate hospitals that perform abortions or clinics that perform abortions that have publicly traded stocks or companies. Do you eliminate, for example, medical device manufacturing companies that make scalpels and clamps and stuff that could be used in an abortion?
No, Tom, we don't.
Okay, so it doesn't get that granular. Interesting. Okay, so let's get to Hobby Lobby. You support their right to say, no, we don't want to provide to pay for health insurance that pays for forms of contraception that we consider to be abortion or that we just disagree with on a religious basis. And yet you believe that they are not, that there's a certain amount of hypocrisy here. Do I have that right?
No, that's incorrect.
Okay.
Mother Jones published that article. But you need to understand, Tom, that most corporations, be they profit or not-for-profit, haven't really given much thought to the fact of where is my money being invested.
Right.
Okay, so just because they have a 401k that happens to use XYZ 401k products, be it Fidelity, Vanguard, whatever, they don't screen their investments by design.
Right. So for people who don't know what we're talking about, if I could just for a second, Stephen, interrupt you and just explain to our listeners and viewers what we're talking about here. The article in Mother Jones basically called out Hobby Lobby as hypocrites, saying that they were investing their employees' 401ks and or pension funds or whatever it was in mutual funds that included companies that manufactured the very pills that they did not want doctors to be able to prescribe to their employees. And they called them out as hypocrites for that. And do I have that part right? And then the corollary to that would presumably be that you're asserting that if they invested with you, they wouldn't have that problem. Is that right?
Spot on.
Okay. So, but they haven't called you up and said, we want to invest with you.
No, because their investment professional probably didn't know we existed.
Interesting. How do you respond to somebody who says that if I buy a stock in a company, you know, that company's not going to see a penny of that money, because I'm buying that stock from another stockholder. You know, unless I'm buying an IPO, if I buy $1 million of Apple stock tomorrow or $10 of Apple stock tomorrow, Apple doesn't see a penny of it. It's money that I bought from some other stockholder who decided on the same day that he or she was going to sell that stock. And therefore, investments should be made based on, factors like, you know, is this stock likely to go up? Is this company likely to pay a dividend? Rather than what is the business that this company is in, because you're really not helping that company at all by buying their or selling their stock. You're just helping some other stockholder.
Well, in part, you're right, but you need to understand, too, Tom, that you're profiting through the dividends, and the more stock that's purchased, the more stock that's issued. So you are, in reality, helping that company gain assets and continue to grow. And
well, you're not helping the company unless you buy into an IPO. But I think your argument that you're taking money from that company in the form of a dividend, and if that's blood money, if you consider that blood money, then you have violated your own moral code, makes perfect sense. So Hobby Lobby is asserting not only a moral code, but the right to impose that moral code on people who may not share it by virtue of the power of being an employer. And that's considerable power in America, particularly right now when you know, it's easier to get into Harvard than to even get a minimum wage job at Walmart. And by not investing appropriately, or at least in a way that's consistent with their stated before the Supreme Court beliefs, they are revealing themselves to be hypocrites. Or somebody should point out to them that their investment advisors are hypocrites. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, maybe the way you put it, but I don't believe so, because if the only way they would be hypocrites, Tom, is if the investment manager knew that he had an investment option and could make that move and the decision.
Well, you think the investment manager has not read the article in Mother Jones?
Well, I'm not sure that he knows or she knows or they know that there are alternatives. We're a niche. Environmentalists have been investing in environmental funds for years. The whole biblically responsible investing movement is just now getting started.
Right. We're talking with Stephen Alley. He is vice president with the Timothy Plan, timothyplan.com, a socially responsible Christian conservative investment fund, portfolio funds. And the Supreme Court, the argument that was made in the Hobby Lobby case, and that probably will carry the day if the Supreme Court rules on behalf of Hobby Lobby, and that could open a whole lot of a real Pandora's box, that could be very, very messy, or maybe not. We'll see how they rule on it. But the main argument that was made was that they had a deeply held conviction. That was the phrase, deeply held conviction. That was the bar, the threshold that their attorneys had to demonstrate to the Supreme Court. Now, the government argued that they didn't have such a deeply held conviction because for decades they've been in business and they've been offering health insurance to their employees that provides for RU-486 and other pills that and for IUDs and things that, that the Hobby Lobby people don't like, and that they really only changed their mind when one of the Koch brothers front groups or funded groups approached them and said, how'd you like to go before the Supreme Court? And they decided to dump their insurance policy and take on Obamacare. But that might be persuasive or it might not. The justices didn't seem to be persuaded by that. But do you think if the justices had known that Hobby Lobby also invested in the very products that they don't want their employees to be able to have, that might have really challenged their argument that they held, that they had a deeply held religious conviction?
I seriously doubt it. But you can flip the coin, Tom, and what if a vegetarian company, somebody that was really, against eating meat, decided that they wanted to go against Obamacare because Obamacare was going to, fund a company that was a slaughterhouse. People have the ability to match their investment decisions with their moral convictions, and that's all Timothy Plan's about.
Right.
What we're saying is Hobby Lobby didn't know. So to slam Hobby Lobby as hypocrites is totally off course.
Okay, so you guys have a fund for Christians. PETA should start an investment fund for vegetarians. Stephen, I'm with you. In fact, I would invest in it. Stephen Alley, Vice President of Timothy Plan, timothyplan.com. Thanks for dropping by, Stephen.
All right, God bless.
Interesting conversation. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And may the Flying Spaghetti Monster bless you, too. We'll be back. Oh, that's great. If you were a member of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, only invest in Chef Boyardee, right? Shane was saying Chef Boyardee. Or are there other spaghetti and meatball companies? There have to be, right? Oh, Ragu. Yeah, okay. So that's an appropriate. All right. Anyhow, Flo in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Flo, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, too.
Tom? I'm just worried about our democracy disappearing. How is my $25 going to compare to people's thousands of dollars? That's all we can afford to contribute.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, it seems that they're catering to rich, wealthy donors. What about the rest of us and our voice?
Well, there is one little ray of light here, and it's the old Jim Morrison song, what was it, 5-4 or 5-1 or whatever the name of the song was. But, it was they got the guns, but we got the numbers. And
we got the numbers. We're poor. Money-wise, do we have the numbers?
The class of people who can afford to throw literally hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars at elections is not just the top 1%. It's much less than the top 1%. It's like the top 1/100th of 1%. Which means that the other 99.99% of us are still in the game. And, I think the Obama campaign demonstrated this in large part by collecting literally millions of dollars for the president's election and for his reelection in the form of $25 contributions. So
Obama has disappointed me in a lot of ways. I talked to you recently about the Monsanto thing. But
by the way, that was a year ago. We looked that up.
That
was a year ago. And that was just part of the omnibus budget. So it wasn't like You know, in other words, the Montana Protection Act got built into the budget, and Obama signed the budget. You know, Bernie Sanders voted for the budget, as I recall. Maybe I'm wrong. But,
well, that's how they operate. They stick things here and there.
I know.
You know, people disappear.
But just so you know, I just wanted
to. Our radio stations, Piers Morgan, I enjoyed listening to him. He was good on gun rights. He wanted some sort of gun control. He's off the air. Dan Rather disappeared. I just don't like how they want to control everything. Time Warner, C-SPAN wants to buy them off.
Will not hear a discussion about that on MSNBC, which is really sad. Or on NBC. It will, you know, Face the Nation.
Piers Morgan, he ended up Friday, and he is so good.
Yeah.
He wants something done about gun violence. I told my husband that's why they're getting rid of him, because he was excellent. When we had catastrophes here, he would have people on a show that they're totally against gun violence. He wanted something done.
Well, he was also a thoughtful guy, and they said his ratings weren't that good. And now they're, you know, running around searching for an airplane and calling psychics and simulating the bottom of the ocean. And it's just, you know, at some point the American people, I think, are maybe not. But I would think at some point the American people are going to say enough with the infotainment already. We would like a real discussion of the real issues. So we'll see where that goes. Flo, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, Phyllis Schlafly is going to be with us in the next hour. That should be an interesting conversation. It's been a while since she's been on the program. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota, listening to AM 950. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Your first two guests are a great example of why your show is so spot on, because you're willing to bring on people that have opinions different than yours, and you represent our side well, so I thank you. But
thank you. I think that's the best way to get the facts out. I think that if we don't basically model for people how to win the water cooler wars, nobody's going to win the water cooler wars. So back to you.
I love to listen to you talk with someone whose firm's arguing before the Supreme Court and going toe-to-toe with them, because it gives hope to those people who are just listening in the distance. But the reason for my call regarded your first guest arguing that speech was money.
Right.
And it seems that conservatives quite often like to talk about the original intent of the founders when they wrote the Constitution. They bring that up often in the argument for gun rights, is the Constitution spoke of a well-armed militia, and that it, for that reason, the intent was that everyone should be able to carry a gun under any circumstances. Well, I cannot imagine that the founders' original intent of the words freedom of speech could ever have conceived of corporations donating or individuals donating hundreds of or tens of millions of dollars to a political candidate. If you think of it in terms of the times, like they want to with their other arguments of original intent, I think all they wanted was to allow a colonist to stand up in the town square and shout about how terrible King George was without being hauled off in shackles.
Yeah, I'm with you. And in fact, I'm looking for a quote. I used to have this great Jefferson quote. I'm going to have to find it after the break, I guess, because I've got this article, How Rich is Too Rich for Democracy, that I wrote way back in 2005, April 18th, 2005, for Common Dreams. And I know that there is a quote in there, I believe that there's a quote in there, from Thomas Jefferson, where he said, I'm not going to rely on the rich. Actually, maybe it's not in that piece. I'll have to find it in another place. But here's Jefferson quotes. Maybe it's here over at TomHartman.com. But Thomas Jefferson was very, you know, he was talking about the Senate, actually, when he went off on that screed. And he was talking about how the Senate had become the body of the rich. And, you know, that's I'm going to have to look it up later. But yeah. So you wanted to talk about original intent. The original intent was not that money should be considered speech under the First Amendment.
gosh, I can't imagine what that's what they had in mind. If it's all about original intent when they want to argue other parts of the Constitution, like gun rights, how could the founders have envisioned corporations funneling money to candidates? I just don't think they had any intent when they spoke of the freedom.
Well, the argument that was made in the oral arguments before Citizens United, before the Supreme Court and Citizens United, and the argument that has been made by some of those same people here on this program, is that at the founding of this republic, the government not only said there shall be no limits on free political speech, but there shall be no limits on newspapers, and that rich people could own newspapers, and their newspaper could say anything they damn well pleased, and so therefore they were using their money as political speech, and that was the original intent. Now, my rebuttal to that would be, at the founding of this country, there were no newspaper syndicates. There were local and individual newspapers owned. They were mostly small enterprises. There were lots and lots of competing newspapers. And when we reached the point in the late 19th century, in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, where you had newspapers so massive that they could actually move the political meter, and what's his name, whose daughter was kidnapped?
Hearst?
Yeah, thank you. William Randolph Hearst and his newspapers. And in the 1890s, he said to Frederick Remington, you know, get me the pictures and I'll give you the war. And Remington supplied him with a photo or a drawing of the USS Maine going down off the coast of Havana. And Hearst ginned up the Spanish-American War. And that the response to that was the Sherman Antitrust Act, which the Supreme Court repeatedly ruled was constitutional. And so we have been regulating the size of speech. But we stopped doing that. Reagan stopped enforcing that act in 1981, or arguably 82, and we've never gone back to it. And thus we have this oligarchy. And it's very concerning, these arguments that are made, I absolutely believe that if we amend the Constitution to say that money is not protected by the First Amendment as speech, then both Democrats and Republicans, with a few exceptions, you got Daryl Issa, who last year made millions of dollars. I mean, he's worth over $100 million, and it's worth a lot of money in any case. And he can legally do insider trading and whatnot. You've got people like him who can finance their own elections, but most, even Republican members of Congress, are offended by the fact that 60% of their time they're sitting in my building calling people, dialing for dollars, and along with the Democrats. And that's why John McCain and Russ Feingold, two polar opposites, got together, put together McCain-Feingold, because they were like, enough of this, let's get these rich people out of the way, and let's just have a political process that has a little more integrity to it. And it's the Supreme Court that keeps preventing that. And we've got to figure out a way around that. And as far as I know, the only way around that, other than changing the composition of the court, which, is not happening anytime soon, as far as I can tell, is to, and without Congress changing the composition of the court, when the FDR was the last guy to try to do that in 1937, is to pass a constitutional amendment that says money is not speech. Money is not protected by the First Amendment, clearly, unambiguously. And, in fact, we're going to have David Cobb in our third hour, the national spokesman for Move to Amend, on to talk about that. So, Todd, thanks for identifying the problem so well, and I think that you're right. I think the founders would be rolling over in their graves, and I'll be back with those Jefferson quotes a little bit later. It is coming up on the top of the hour here. Phyllis Schlafly is going to be with us on the way back. She's concerned about the Paycheck Fairness Act. Women don't really need this stuff, she says. Well, I'll let her say it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and I'm pleased and honored to welcome back to our program Phyllis Schlafly, conservative author and activist, constitutional lawyer, founder of the Eagle Forum. EagleForum.org is her website, and the Twitter is at Phyllis Schlafly or at Eagle Forum or at Eagle Forum DC. And Ms. Schlafly, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. I often reference the several conversations that we've had over the years about how Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and how the Supreme Court has been engaging in this doctrine of judicial review in a way that would have horrified the founders of our country. I'm curious, assuming that you still feel that way, your thoughts before we get into this thing about the Paycheck Fairness Act, your thoughts on today's McCutcheon decision.
Which decision?
Today, the Supreme Court ruled that there are no aggregate limits that billionaires, the number of politicians that a billionaire can buy, basically.
There are no limits?
No aggregate limit, yeah. There used to be a limit of $123,000 total. You could buy individual politicians, or you could make donations to individual politicians at the rate of, I think, $2,200 per politician. And they blew that up. If you're not familiar with it, I didn't mean to...
No, I'm really not. You're
okay.
Ahead of me.
Okay.
I just haven't had time to look at the news today.
Okay, that's fine. We'll have that conversation another time.
But I do think there ought to be some limits. That sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it is, too. The Paycheck Fairness Act, back in 2010, you were writing about this. It was the last time that it was, you know, seriously advanced. Now Harry Reid is talking about bringing it back up again, basically saying that women should have a legal fallback if they find that their employer is paying them less than a man for the exact same job. Am I accurately characterizing the law, first of all?
No, it's not the exact same job. We all believe and support the present law, which calls for equal pay for equal work. But that's not what the feminists want. And, of course, the Obama administration and his pals do whatever the feminists want. They can really control his administration. They want equal pay for equal worth. Now, worth is a very subjective statement. You might think one job is worth more than another. When you talk about worth, you're talking about other conditions that might be part of the job. And that is not something that ought to be legislated by the government. We'll leave something to the free market, the employer and the employee.
Sure. Well, you and I are both old enough to remember the days of newspaper ads that said men wanted and women wanted and you know, the just open disparities in the workplace based on gender. How do we, if we don't use something like the Paycheck Protection, Paycheck Fairness Act or whatever it's called, if we don't do that, how do we prevent men who overwhelmingly control the workplace from discriminating against women with regard to money, particularly in this day and age when more and more single women or single mothers are literally, you know, the main paycheck or the only paycheck that's providing for a household?
Well, what is the purpose? Is the purpose to get all women in the workforce? I don't think that's an appropriate government purpose. I think people should have their opportunity to go for a job if they want it, and if they apply for it, do the work.
Right.
But I don't think that we should craft the laws to make sure that the women get in to the workforce in equal numbers.
Well, I'm not suggesting that. I'm asking the question, and this isn't a gotcha question. I genuinely don't have an answer for this. I think that, though, this is what this bill is trying to do. is how do you protect women who are currently in the workforce, who are in a workforce that is male-controlled, male-dominated, and has a long history of paying women less than men, in some cases for the same job and in many cases for similar jobs. How do we...
Well, we've got a whole federal department called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, mm-hmm. and all those busybody bureaucrats have the job of making sure that women get equal pay for equal work. And I think that's a good law, and they've got plenty of bureaucrats who are dealing with that. So what is the problem? A lot of men think women control the workforce.
I don't know any men who think that.
At any rate, there are plenty of women who simply don't want the same treatment as men. For example, most women don't want to work the full week that men work. Men want full-time jobs. Women want the ability to knock it off and take shorter hours so they can be home with her family and do other things.
Well, I'd like the ability to knock it off and take shorter hours, too.
There is this new phenomenon. I've learned a new word in recent years. It's hypergamy. When women get married, they like the gender gap. They want to marry a man who earns more than she does.
Hypergamy?
Hypergamy.
And what does that word mean?
It means that the woman wants to marry a man who makes more money than she does.
Uh-huh.
So that when she has a baby or she gets tired of the rat race in the workforce, she can take off or work fewer hours.
Well, I can understand some women feeling that way. I can understand some men feeling that way, you know, wanting to marry a woman who's
It's overwhelmingly women who feel that way.
Yeah, okay. Well, be that the or not, I think that we've probably hashed this one out. I'm curious if we could go back to where we started. Your thoughts on judicial review these days, on the idea that, I mean, in the first 70 years of our republic, it only happened twice that the Supreme Court said we have the right to strike down laws passed by Congress. Once in 1803 and Marbury versus Madison, and then the second in 1856 in Dred Scott, and we all know how that worked out. But now that's pretty much all they do is basically make law. What are your thoughts on that today?
Well, the name of my book is The Supremacists. These judges get to think they're supreme over everybody else, and I don't think they are. And I think we now have all of these supremacist judges that are knocking down the state marriage laws, and I think it's an outrage. And I think we should act the way Dred Scott did, the way Abe Lincoln did about Dred Scott, when the Supreme Court handed down the worst decision on record and said that Dred Scott was... the property of his master. Lincoln said, well, okay, we have to go along with whatever the court ruled about that poor guy, but we don't need to make it a national rule, because if we let the Supreme Court make national rules like that, we will no longer be a self-governing people, and we will be subject to that eminent tribunal.
Hmm.
And I think the courts are just out of line. That's why I call them supremacist. I think mm-hmm. the American people should stop it.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that's one of the biggest crises that we face as a democracy is that we now have a constitutional monarchy. We have 9 monarchs here in Washington D.C., 3 blocks from where I'm sitting, who basically are making our laws rather than we the people. What can we do about this? We have just a minute left, Phyllis Schlafly.
Well, we want to make sure we don't confirm any more Obama judges.
Okay.
Because his judges, the ones he's appointed, are the supremacist type.
What about an article?
Starters, but
what about an Article 3, Section 2 sort of solution where Congress regulates the Supreme Court?
Well, Congress doesn't regulate the Supreme Court, but what Congress can do is to withdraw jurisdiction over those areas where we don't trust the court.
Hmm.
And we don't trust them to remake the definition of marriage. That's not the court's job. That's a legislative function.
Right.
And we don't trust what they've been doing on a lot of religion cases, on the Boy Scouts, and a lot of other things.
Yeah, I'm with you. We may disagree on some of the individual issues, but in principle, I am totally with you. Phyllis Schlafly, eagleforum.org.
Go to my website for any more info.
Okay, yeah, eagleforum.org. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Schlafly.
Have a good day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Phyllis Schlafly, she is an extraordinary woman who has been fighting the good fight, her good fight, but the good fight for many, many years. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, that was interesting. We've got to get Phyllis Schlafly on and just do a whole segment on judicial review. Because she's so right. And in fact, she makes the point that I don't make often enough, which is that Congress can regulate the jurisdiction of the court under Article 3, Section 2, and should do so. Congress can pass a law right now that says that the Supreme Court does not have authority to decide anything that has to do with the nature of money and its relationship to the Constitution, because the word money does not appear in the Constitution. Fascinating. So, anyhow, let's pick up Free Speech TV. Bob in Sacramento, California. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up, Bob?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great.
It's the general run of these conservative commentators that you have on the show, and this one, and the big picture as well, the lone liberal rumble and all that. A lot of times, I just have to stop listening to them.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because at this point, with what we know of science and what we know of the economy and what we know of biology, chemistry, and physics, that they are willfully ignorant.
Well, in some cases, I mean, I've pretty much stopped inviting Mark Morano on because he lies about the climate. I mean, you know, the people who I've had on this program and on the TV show who I know are intentionally lying just because they're trying to get, you know, a paycheck because they're in somebody's pocket, I don't invite on. But there is a viewpoint that believes that plutocracy is good, that it leads to a stable society. It's the core belief of conservatives. I mean, it's the definition of conservative belief is, you know, this is society needs stability. And somebody needs to talk back to these people.
You're cutting out.
I said somebody needs to talk back to these people, and if not me, who?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean,
they go on David Gregory's show on Meet the Press, and they blather their stuff, and nobody says, hey, wait a minute, that's not right.
Yeah, it's just hard to listen to them.
No, I understand. And but let me tell you, Bob, for every person who finds it hard to listen, there's, I'm just guessing, but probably 10 or 20 who find it fascinating, find it useful, because they've got a brother-in-law who talks like that, and they'd like to know how to talk back to him. And, you know, some of these arguments haven't occurred to them, or they don't know how to talk back to them without, you know, fistfights involved. And so I believe personally that we are performing an important public service by having conservatives on with whom I disagree and having rational disagreements with them. And that's why I look for high integrity conservatives. Phyllis Schlafly really believes what she has to say. And there actually are areas where she and I totally agree. But she believes what she has to say. That's
one of the things that she... I'm sorry to interrupt, Tom, but one of the things that she said was that it's the Obama judges.
Oh, I know. But Bob,
Obama hasn't had any judges approved.
Well, actually, he's had two, Kagan and Sotomayor. That's who she's talking about. But you know, I didn't challenge her on saying that because I give my viewing audience and my listeners enough credit. I believe that y'all are smart enough to know that, you know, what the truth is or what my position would be on that. So, I mean, I'll let her say that. It's fine. Bob, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes. As I said, I've got to do a half hour sometime with Phyllis Schlafly because she reminded me of things that I had forgotten. I mean, I talk about how the Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says, and I will read it to you just so that you have it right at the top of your head. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. So Congress can make exceptions. I've always focused on the regulations word. Phyllis Schlafly was just focusing on the exceptions word. Congress can establish exceptions to what the Supreme Court can rule on. And so Congress could pass a law tomorrow, at least in theory. Shane's laughing. Of course they would. Congress can pass a law tomorrow saying that the Supreme Court may not rule on issues that have to do with money and politics because the word money does not appear in the Constitution. And as Shane pointed out, the Supreme Court would strike it down as unconstitutional. And Congress then could say, we're going to ignore what the Supreme Court said. And as long as the president goes along with it, because he's the one charged with executing the laws, as long as the president ignores the Supreme Court, then, you know, that's the way it goes. And this, and in fact, that has happened in our history. Andrew Jackson displaced a whole bunch of Cherokees out of Georgia and drove them to Oklahoma. And didn't drive them in a car, right? I mean, you know, drove them literally at gunpoint, walking, and many of them died. And a representative for the Cherokees went before the United States Supreme Court, and this was in the 1820s, 1830s, whenever Andrew Jackson was president, first half of the 19th century, and argued before the court that this was unconstitutional to move these Native Americans from one state to another, or from a state to a territory. And the Supreme Court agreed with him. George Marshall was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Yes, that George Marshall, the guy who was Jefferson's second cousin, who Jefferson hated, the guy who ruled in Marbury v. Madison. And George Marshall ruled, you can't do that, President Jackson. And Andrew Jackson said, let George Marshall, the words to the effect of, I don't remember the exact quote. Do you remember the exact quote, Shano? Okay, whatever the exact quote was, and probably somebody in our chat room will toss it out, or somebody on Twitter. But basically, what Andrew Jackson, President Jackson, said was, George Marshall has made his decision. Let him enforce it. Right? In other words, he doesn't have an army. I do. And that was the point that back in Federalist, either 80, 81, 82, 83, or 84, it's one of the early 80s, that Alexander Hamilton made, that the Supreme Court was most likely going to be the least pernicious of the three branches of government because they had no power of the purse. Only Congress can appropriate money. And they had no power of the sword. Only the executive branch can run the army. The president is the commander-in-chief of the military. So the Supreme Court has no mechanism to enforce what they have to say. And as Phyllis Schlafly correctly pointed out just a few minutes ago on this program, and you will not find another person on earth whose politics are more different than mine. Well, maybe you will. I mean, maybe Karl Rove. I don't know. You know, although, you know, Karl Rove actually doesn't have any politics. Politics requires scruples. Phyllis Schlafly actually believes what she says. She is a scrupulous woman. I disagree with her totally, and she reminds me of my father. I disagree with her totally, and I have so much respect for her. And her point was that Congress can make the most important point she made about Dred Scott, when she pointed out what Lincoln said, was that, okay, the Supreme Court ruled that Mr. Sanford owned Mr. Scott. So what President Lincoln said was, the way that we should deal with this, the way that I'm going to respond to this, is to say to Mr. Scott, sorry, you poor SOB, Mr. Sanford owns you. But that doesn't mean that all the other slaves are owned by their masters. That just means that the Supreme Court ruled in this one case that this one guy is owned by this one slave owner. And Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who ruled in Dred Scott and who wrote the decision and thought that he was going to put to bed forever the debate about slavery in America, when in fact he did the exact opposite. I mean, he initiated the Civil War, thought that President Lincoln was going to say, oh, well, the Supreme Court has said that, slave owners have the right to own their slaves. So all those northern states that have outlawed slavery, they're going to have to un-outlaw slavery because I, Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, I have spoken. And Abraham Lincoln said, screw that. You know, Mr. Scott, Mr. Dred Scott, sorry, you're the property, Mr. Taney, but all the others, no. Here's an Emancipation Proclamation. I don't give a damn what the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court says. President Obama could do the same thing right now. He could say, okay, fine. The Supreme Court has ruled that Sean McCutcheon can make unlimited contributions. But that doesn't mean that David Koch can. He has the power to say that. Abraham Lincoln, his hero, said that. Come on, Obama. I know over at the White House you guys listen to this show. Somebody tell the president. Listen to Phyllis Schlafly about Abraham Lincoln.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And tell him that Tom Hartman sent you and told you that. Oh, man. We'll be back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very epigonously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good. OK Cupid. To protest Mozilla Firefox's hiring a new anti-gay CEO by a fellow by the name of Brendan Eich. The dating website has posted a message on its website that appears only to OK Cupid users who use Mozilla Firefox to surf the web. The message informs the user that since, quote, Mozilla's new CEO is an opponent of equal rights for gay couples, OKCupid would therefore prefer that our users do not use Mozilla software to access OKCupid. It's not always that a business puts doing what's right over doing what makes money, so kudos to OKCupid for making clear where they stand on equal rights. Is that a corporation having a religion? No. Let's not go there. The bad. Representative Louie Gohmert. Who else? During a recent appearance on WorldNet Daily to promote a Christian TV event called Washington, a Man of Prayer, the Texas congressman argued that the phrase separation of church and state meant that religion should play a role in government. Seriously, check it out.
We're talking about the guy who coined the phrase separation of church and state, who said there should be a wall of separation between church and state. But it was to be a one-way wall where the state would not dictate to the church, but the church would certainly play a role in the state.
Actually, Jefferson didn't want religion to play that kind of role in government at all. But regardless of how well Representative Gohmert understands his Thomas Jefferson, the First Amendment clearly says, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And that's about the best argument you can make against the kind of religious government that Gohmert wants here in the United States. Is he dumb or does he just pretend? You know, is that just his performance? Louie Gohmert, I'm still scratching my head around. And the very, very ugly, Angela Timmons, the 54-year-old employee of Virginia College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, today is under fire for an incredibly stupid April Fool's joke she tried to play on her daughter yesterday. Right after she got to work, Timmons sent her daughter a text message letting her know that she heard gunshots on campus and there was a shooting going on. Not surprisingly, Timmons' daughter then called the police, who then rushed over to Virginia College. The police then, of course, found out that nothing was going on and arrested Timmons for breaking the peace. April Fools or not, there's nothing funny about school shootings. That is very, very funny. Or a very bad sense of humor. I mean, that's not even humor, right? That's incredible. Okay, so Tom learned something from Phyllis Schlafly. It's an interesting day. What can I say? 23 minutes before the hour, and Catherine in, I've lost part of my...
Madison.
Madison, okay, thank you, in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm totally there. Lost. I do appreciate when you talk to people like that because you do respond back. But Phyllis was here a couple of weeks ago conferring with Senator Grossman and other Republicans here before our last week of the legislature. And Senator Grossman, as I call him, Senator Grossman, was the one that pushed through and got through taking away equal pay for women and the right for compensatory damages in court.
Right.
So she really confuses me.
Well, she's opposed to equal pay for women. And I mean, you know, Phyllis Schlafly, that That part of that debate I gave up on because she said her piece, I said my piece, and it was obvious right. that we were not going to meet minds, and I wasn't going to start calling her names. But
that's fine.
And I thought that what she said was so transparent that she basically wants to take us back to the 1950s.
Well, not only that, but you know when we had the rallies here and everything, they said people came from other states. They're coming in here and changing everything, and they don't live here.
Right.
I mean, Karl Rove has his protege, who's the far right hand of Walker.
Well, and Walker's getting his money from the Koch brothers. They live
and
in Wichita.
Koch brothers? Yeah, I mean, talk about interfering in other states. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. I wonder who else was here besides her. I mean, we kind of see, the planes go back and forth, the private jets, mm-hmm. and we know a lot of people come in. But I'd like to know exactly, what she was doing here. I'd love it if you'd ask her, exactly.
Okay. Next time I have her on, I will. I'm guessing that her answer would be I was consulting with the Republicans.
Why? She doesn't live in Wisconsin. I mean, that's what they use on.
Well, Wisconsin is this laboratory right now. They're doing all kinds of experiments to you four poor folks who live in Wisconsin. And Scott Walker is running for president of the United States. And the Koch brothers are backing him, or at least have so far. And I think he has a shot, actually, because he has this nice guy persona, even though his policies are just every bit as cruel and despicable and sociopathic as Paul Ryan's. And Paul Ryan's from Wisconsin, too, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I hear those people down in Janesville have just about had it with him.
Well,
which is a good thing.
One can hope. Catherine, thank you for the call. We'll see what we can find out. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, if speech is money, then money is... I'm not saying this right. Then money is speech. Anyway, what I'm getting at is I just want the Koch brothers to tell me what the trade ratio is. I'm serious. I mean, can I buy Great Northern for 10 minutes of speech? I'm being serious. I think that when the Supreme Court makes a decision, words have meaning. Words have consequences. I would like to see the Supreme Court justify that analogy. Justify it. Please explain to the American people how speech, money equals speech. I don't think that's an unrealistic requirement.
Well, they have not said that. They've said two things. They've said, number one, money facilitates speech. In other words, you buy commercials on television in which you speak. So money facilitates speech. And therefore, because it facilitates speech, that speech should be protected and the protection should accrue to the money as well, number one. And number two, and you can read this in Citizens United. The Citizens United decision is only about 90 pages long, and it's actually quite readable. I recommend it to everybody. In Citizens United, they make the argument that because some of the most significant actors economically in our country, some of the most significant actors in our country are big corporations, and they have things to say that we need to know about in order to function, in order to conduct our daily lives, that we are harmed if the government stifles the speech of these big corporations or the billionaires who run them, and therefore our right to hear is impaired. Those were the two arguments that the Supreme Court made. They didn't say A equals B and therefore B equals A, which is what you're trying to say. So I get your logic, Bill, and I think it's a great one, but FYI and for the record. Thanks a lot for the call. Robert in Ontario, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom, appreciate you taking my call. So the McCutcheon decision, no surprises there, right?
Right. None for me.
None for me either. And you asked a very good question last hour. What do we do? And I'm also glad that you had mentioned Marianne Williamson's campaign.
She is going to be on the program in about a half hour, and David Cobb is going to be on the program in about 20 minutes.
Well, fantastic. Point I want to make is... she's declared that she's not taking any PAC money. She's not taking any money from special interests, which is fantastic. However, I think there's two steps that need to be taken, and I want to refer to a political blogger by the name of Jude Fawley writing in the Daily Coast and basically addressing Marianne Williamson directly. And he said, she needs to take the fight to her rivals and make it an issue. And that's why we're losing on this. We're not making it an issue that voters can vote for. And at least in Los Angeles, people living in the district that Marianne Williams is running for, they have an option to vote on campaign finance, you know, albeit it's in a de facto form. The other point that Jude Foley makes is that we have to bring voters into this conversation, and we have to address our culpability for not demanding candidates to not take money from wealthy sources, you know. Right. And so that's the other point that I'd like to drive home as well.
Yeah. I you know, I'm with you. And these are the things that when you go to your member of Congress's town hall meeting or your local state legislators, or you organize a town meeting and you shame them into showing up, these are the issues that you need to be bringing up. Or if you start a local Progressive Democrats of America group, or a local Move to Amend group, or a local MoveOn.org group, or whatever it may be, there's a lot of great organizations out there, democracyforamerica.com, that, you know, that help you set these things up. These are the topics that you should be bringing up. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Evergreen Park, Illinois.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
You think Roe v. Wade was worse than Dred Scott?
I do, Tom, because, and I'm not saying that Dred Scott was good. Obviously, I think it was an incredible demonic decision. But in that decision, they said you cannot or you could enslave a person. But I think in Roe versus Wade, the court was saying it's okay if you want to kill a person.
No, actually, they didn't say that. What they said is that a fetus is not a person until the third trimester, and you may not abort a baby during the third trimester unless the life of the mother is at stake or the baby is so malformed that it's going to die.
You're talking a little bit too fast here, because Bolton versus Doe, in that same decision, allowed a mother for a medical reason to destroy their baby up to the ninth month.
That's right, for a medical reason. If it's going to kill mom to have the baby, you can abort the baby. But I'm opposed to Roe v. Wade because this should have been done legislatively. And the fact that it wasn't, the reason why it was done by the Supreme Court, is why we're still having this debate 30, 40, 50 years later. John, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And back to Phyllis Schlafly, that's basically her argument, too, is that this should have been done legislatively, state by state or at the federal government. It should be the will of the people, not the will of nine justices. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Josie, watching Free Speech TV in China Grove, North Carolina. Hey, Josie, what's up? Josie? Am I saying it right? J-O-C-I-E? Apparently, Josie is listening to her TV instead of her telephone. James in Reno, Nevada, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, James, what's on your mind? Uh-oh. Have we lost our calls? Has Comcast nuked our telephone system? Let's try another one. Walter in Cherokee Village, Arkansas. Are you there, Walter? Oh, man. No, it's working. Okay, Walter, I'm not hearing Walter. Are you sure all the pots and everything are in the right place over there? Okay. Let's see if Wren in Edmonds, Washington. Wren?
Yeah, this is Wren. How are you doing today?
So some of our lines are working. I'm fine.
Yeah, that's good. My point is I was reading an article on the Daily Beast, and they're saying that part of the thought process in the Supreme Court decision is that if you give $500 to a politician, that is, you know, would plainly not be a pro or quid quo pro on a national, you know, rational thing. If I give $500 to a senator, yet it's not, I'm not going to influence his decision. But, and then so the Supreme Court is saying, well, if you give $500 to 10,000 politicians, that is in and of itself not,
right. Well, the amount, by the way, was $2,200 or $2,300.
Yeah,
that's the limit.
In the article, they're just using 500 as an example. Well, if Bank of America steals a dollar from me, that's not a felony. If they steal a dollar from 1,000 or 1,000,000 customers, that then the aggregate of it becomes a felony.
Right.
So if I'm giving $500...
Something they do routinely, by the way.
Yeah,
it's arguable.
Exactly. Yeah, where if I'm giving, you know, X amount of money to every single politician in a particular party or who has a particular, you know, stated belief in a particular idea or legislation... In aggregate, that then becomes quid pro quo.
Hmm?
Does it not?
Yeah, arguably. I mean, this. I think the most flawed part of the Supreme Court's logic was that if you give money, first of all, in the dissent, who wrote the dissent? Stephen Breyer. Thank you. In Breyer's dissent, he pointed out that the way that individual candidacies and state parties and federal parties work together, it is possible under this decision for one person to give $3.6 million to one candidate for federal office. That is going to get somebody's attention, $3.6 million. And he laid out how it could be done. So, A, you know, you can buy a hell of a lot of influence with $3.6 million. B, they said that, yes, that $2,200 might buy you access. You know, the congressman or woman might have a meeting with you, might take your phone call when they wouldn't take a meeting with or a phone call from the average person who hadn't donated to them. But that in and of itself doesn't constitute corruption. In my mind, that in and of itself does constitute corruption.
Yeah, it reminds me of this Monty Python sketch of, you know, does she go? Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Are you familiar with that sketch?
No, I'm not.
Oh, if you look it up, it perfectly says what the Supreme Court is now saying, that I give you $1 million and it has absolutely nothing to do with a quid pro quo. Unless we actually say I'm giving you $1 million to vote this way, it actually has no corrupting influence on that particular politician.
Right. And if you believe that, I got a bridge in New Jersey with a couple of closed lanes to sell you. Ren, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. And we will be back in just a moment with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Robert Ney, Bob Ney, former congressman and current reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, and author of the absolutely brilliant book Sideswiped, which is all about how Washington really works and the crimes that John Boehner actually committed. If you haven't read it, you need to. Hey, Bob.
Thank you. How are you, Tom?
I am good. Very well, thank you. It's always nice to hear your voice. So what's going on in the world?
Well, speaking of crimes, corruption, and money, the Supreme Court decision,
McCutcheon,
is absolutely amazing, because they also did distinguish between a, quote, a sort of a regular citizen that's under the $2,600 limit, individual contributions, but a more wealthy citizen becomes the free speech, whereas the individual is still limited. And that part of that decision, I really couldn't follow. I think it's making some heads turn.
Yeah, I think so.
And also, the influence into the parties and the PACs will be huge. I mean, this will be money as never, ever seen before. And, of course, as you know, this is the second round of decisions with Citizens United and now this decision that will absolutely open a floodgate beyond comprehension.
A couple of quick quotes from Thomas Jefferson apropos of this. I am not among those who fear the people. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. He also wrote, those seeking profits, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge. Anyway, back to you, Bob. Bob? How could that phone go down? We lost Bob Ney. Okay, I'm going to hang up. We're going to try and get Bob back. And obviously, we need to reboot our phone server system, which we would do at the top of the hour. But we're going to get Bob back on the phone. While we're doing that, I'll give you some more Thomas Jefferson quotes. That liberty is pure, which is to go to all and not to the few or the rich alone. That's Thomas Jefferson in a letter to Horatio Gates in 1798. I read you those seeking profit. He said, a totally free market where corporations reign supreme could transform America until the bulk of the society is reduced to mere automatons of misery, to have no sensibilities left but for sinning and suffering. Okay, Bob is back. Okay, Bob, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. We apparently have a problem with our hybrid here. We've got to reboot it.
It might be the NSA also.
Oh, it could be the NSA, yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, in fact, I'm surprised my mind didn't go there first. So, what else is up?
Well, speaking of the NSA, I thought this was very interesting, because it's really raised the dander with Senator Ron Wyden, who is a Democratic member from Oregon, and also Senator Mark Udall, a Democratic member from Colorado. They made a joint statement, and it's in regards to the U.S. intelligence chiefs who have confirmed for the first time the NSA did use a, quote, backdoor in a surveillance law to perform warrantless searches on Americans' calls and emails. This is the first time they've actually said, yes, we use the backdoor process. So
a backdoor is software built into your computer that lets them sneak into your computer without your knowledge?
Well, that's what that does, but in this case, it's different. What they're saying is they're using a backdoor in the law, surveillance law passed. They went through the law and they said, okay, we can look at foreign intelligence targeting, you know, for foreign intelligence, but that's for non-U.S., you know, persons believed to be outside the United States. But they took that and said, also, anybody who is a U.S. person dealing with people outside of the United States or outside the United States themselves, then that law applies to them, and we can just go without a warrant and start mining their information.
Okay, I'm part of a
and found a loophole.
I'm part of a little prayer circle that came out of this nonprofit that I worked for in Germany for years and years and years, Salem International. And every Friday we all send each other Shabbat Shalom, you know, happy weekend, and occasionally pray for somebody collectively. Most of those people are outside the United States. They're in Germany, they're in Scotland, they're in Australia, they're in the Philippines. They're all over the world. In fact, I think there's only three of us in the United States. Does that mean that just those Friday emails are being read by the NSA, or does that mean that the NSA has decided, because I do that every week, I have these international conversations, that they can read all of my email?
That's a perfect ability to use a backdoor loophole to read what you have.
And read all of it, or read just the stuff that involves other people from other countries? Or do we not know?
I hesitate to speculate, but I would say everything, because they've mined everything.
Right.
I mean, they have.
Right.
And this is the first time they've admitted they didn't get warrants.
Amazing.
They've always said they've had warrants.
Wouldn't it be weird if I was being monitored by the NSA, not because I'm a liberal talk show host, but
because you're in a prayer.
Because I'm in a prayer circle that includes, you know, people who have hung out with the Dalai Lama. Very strange. Okay.
That's true.
Other new, actually,
yes.
You've hung out with
Another
the Dalai
thing
Lama.
Too is the CIA report. Even John McCain is saying, oh, you know, it's a tough report to read. What they found out is they already had information, tortured people anyway,
right.
And then the information was, you know, very invalid, you know, a whole brand new series of things. But, you know, I would say as John McCain is horrified by this, he wasn't too horrified when the Bush administration, under Alberto Gonzalez, just shredded the Constitution, did as it pleased with torture.
Right.
So it's going to be some horrific things in that report when made public.
Is it going to be made public?
I think it is. I would think that it will be. It might take about 3 months.
Yeah.
But I think
there'll
be a lot.
Quick question, Bob. We just have a half a minute left, but you're an astute political observer and a former member of Congress. If the Democrats start running toward the midterms on the success of Obamacare, can they win?
I think what they have to do is, it'll help what happened yesterday, but I think what they have to do is don't get sucked into the trap of where they're standing there defending their vote. Well, you know, I should have changed this or that. Just, you know, here it is, give it some time, the people registered, and I don't think it's going to be a detriment to them unless they let the Republican side just, you know, suck them into the entire conversation.
I agree. Don't be nuanced. Just say, damn it, yes. It's a good start.
I supported it. It's okay.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And we are now going to reboot our phones. In fact, I'm going to close my call screener, and we will be back with David Cobb, phone gods willing, with Move to Amend.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And the McCutcheon case was decided today. Billionaires can now give money to an unlimited number of politicians. Yes, you can buy as many politicians as you want, David Koch. You should be delighted. Or Sean McCutcheon, actually, in this case. You should be delighted. David Cobb, the national spokesperson for Move to Amend, movetoamend.org, is on the line with us. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. So, first of all, your thoughts on McCutcheon.
Well, first of all, let's just be clear that this is just a continuation of the illegitimate court-created idea that money equals speech. Yes, it makes things worse, but it's not anything that we at Move to Amend did not expect, and it is something that we are going to have to address. And, Tom, I want to take a moment to underscore it simply proves that it is going to take a constitutional amendment to abolish this illegitimate court-created doctrine. Legislation is, yes, we should do it, but we should be under no illusion that we're actually going to be able to take control of our country unless we abolish this idea and rip it up by the roots.
Yeah. Now, I we do that by passing a constitutional amendment that unambiguously says money is not speech, and corporations, be they for-profit or not-for-profit, are not persons. Thus, money has no protection under the First Amendment, and corporations of any form have no protection under the 14th Amendment, correct?
That's exactly right. And, Tom, I want to take this moment in the light of the McCutcheon case, which is a bad case, right? I'm not trying to sidestep that, but I want to contextualize the movement that is growing. You know, in March, just last month, in New Hampshire town hall meetings, Move to Amend passed 48 resolutions of support. In yesterday, in Wisconsin, 13 more communities passed resolutions in support. And get this, Tom, in very conservative, Republican-dominated areas in Wisconsin. I'm talking about Waukesha. 69% voted in favor of Move to Amend, and Waukesha is the place where for the last 30 years they have voted for Republican presidential candidates. They have voted for Republican congressional candidates. This is the very heart of Scott Walker's Wisconsin, and we at Move to Amend have found a way to frame this argument in a way that cuts across political ideologies, cuts across issues, and recognizes the agreement that the American people had on the principle this is supposed to be a democratic republic. We, the people, are supposed to be sovereign. We're supposed to rule ourselves. And our Constitution is supposed to protect individual rights, that individual rights cannot be actually violated by the political process. And that's the kicker, Tom. Corporations do not have constitutional rights. They only have privileges under law. That conversation is being had in pool halls, in bowling alleys, in taverns, all across Wisconsin, all across New Hampshire, and soon all across this country.
David, I had Phyllis Schlafly on the program in the previous hour. And I don't know if you're familiar with her work or you've ever read her book, The Supremes?
Yep.
Okay. She's, you know, I asked her thoughts on this. She was not all that up on McCutcheon specifically, but she said she felt that there should be limits on campaign contributions and that it was a reasonable thing. And with regard to the Supreme Court decision, she said that she pointed out that Article 3, Section 2 says that, you know, I've always focused on, you know, that the court shall operate under such regulations as the Congress shall make. But she said it also says with such exceptions. She said Congress could pass a law saying that the Supreme Court may not rule on issues that have to do with money because the word money does not appear in the Supreme Court or in the Constitution. And
here's the thing, Tom, that actually is legally correct. And it underscores this. There is no shortage of tools and mechanisms that could be used in a genuine, robust democracy movement. You know, what you and I know is that corporate charter revocation proceedings could be initiated against all of these corporations that are causing such rapacious harm to the environment or to workers or to public health and public safety. So the point that we make at Move to Amend is we need to build a genuine democracy movement where ordinary people are participating, building independent political power, independent of both the Democratic and Republican Party leadership, and simply demanding that these artificial entities created under law are actually serving the public's interest. So whether it's congressional action, whether it's state action through this chartering process or certificates of authority to do business, there is no shortage of tools that are available if we had a vibrant democracy movement that was coherent, cohesive, and really took itself seriously.
Yeah, there you go. She also pointed out that Abraham Lincoln, when the Dred Scott decision happened, basically said, this decision stinks, and Mr. Scott, you are the property of Mr. Sanford, but that doesn't mean that the northern states that have banned slavery are going to have to unban slavery. I'm not going to apply this to the whole country. And that President Obama could do the same thing right now. He could say, okay, Mr. McCutcheon, you can give money to an unlimited number of people. The Supreme Court just ruled that. But that doesn't mean that anybody else can. David Koch can't. What do you think of that?
Right. And this is the point. Are we taking this movement as seriously as the abolitionists did, as the women's suffrage movement did, as the civil rights movement did? We know, Tom, you know, I know, your listeners and viewers know that the court is wrong on the law, they're wrong on logic, they're on the wrong side of history. But are we merely going to take it, or are we going to do what people before us have done, which is to educate, agitate, and organize? And this is the reason that, you know, Tom, I have the privilege of traveling the country. As you know, I'm on the road about one-half to two-thirds of my life. Part of the reason I come on this program so enthusiastic every time we talk is because I'm in another location where I've had yet another meeting with yet another group of people who are ready to take action. And, Tom, here's the thing. Almost everybody coming in the Move to Amend are not traditional activists. These are ordinary people who have finally said, ya basta, enough already. This craziness has got to stop. And we're getting people involved in the political process, many of whom have never done anything other than pull a lever in elections. And so to me, when you make references to the Dred Scott decision and the abolitionist movement and I hear Phyllis Schlafly talking about the first principles of how our constitutional republic are supposed to operate, see, this excites me because these are the conversations that are desperately needed in this country, and what I know is they're starting to happen. And it's just exciting to me. I can't help it. Move to Men is getting larger, stronger, and better organized every day, and we encourage your listeners and your viewers to not just get educated, not just get angry, get involved.
Yeah, and I pitch that almost every single day. I'm so totally with you.
We can always tell, Tom, if we were a corporation, we would owe you dividends on shares.
Well, that's, you know, thank you. And I'm glad it's working. June 26, 1857, President Lincoln, in response to Dred Scott, he said, this same Supreme Court once decided a national bank to be constitutional. But General Jackson, as President of the United States, disregarded that decision and vetoed a bill for a recharter, partly on constitutional grounds, declaring that every public functionary must support the Constitution as he understands it. Abraham Lincoln?
And here's the thing, Tom, I want to really underscore the principle that's at play there, both with Jackson and Lincoln, and was true during the populist uprising, and has been true up until only about the last 60 or 70 years, was a principle that historians call the idea of the sovereignty of the citizens. Who best to protect and to interpret the Constitution? Answer, actually, the American people.
Right.
And that's why what you know, what I know, is that this is a battle over the hearts and minds of the American people. Are we going to be cowed, or do we actually believe in sort of the popular sovereignty of we the people? The only time the court should ever overturn a democratically enacted law, whether we like that law or not, the only time that the court should overturn a law is if a human being's constitutional rights are being violated. And it's very clear that in Citizens United, in the McCutcheon case, it was not a constitutional right being violated. And that's the reason that this movement is growing, is because we're talking to ordinary people in a way that they can understand and inviting them into a movement that they can understand as a pathway to win.
Hang on just a second, David.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
David Cobb, Move to Amend, the website, movetoamend.org. Get over there, check it out, sign it up, sign up for it. David, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Corky watching Free Speech TV in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I want to talk about the Hobby Lobby. I'm
yeah.
sick of the religious right getting into my life and my government.
Right.
Now, when you prescribe, when a doctor prescribes a drug, the drug isn't always for the purpose. It also covers other things,
right.
such as menstrual cycles that are too heavy. They prescribe birth control, the Control Act.
Right.
And the abortion pill, there's other uses for that.
But even if there weren't, it shouldn't be the business of your employer.
How do you know what my doctor's telling me I need to take?
Hobby Lobby wants to know if your doctor is even having a conversation with you about IUDs or birth control devices. And if the doctor is having that conversation with you, Hobby Lobby wants to make sure that that doctor doesn't get paid.
Well, how can he be in the room with me? How does he know why the doctor's prescribing that drug for me?
Right. Well, that's...
I mean, they have no business in the room. They have no business. What happened to HIPAA?
I agree with you, but, well, you know, I'm not sure the HIPAA is our best defense. What happened to common sense might be a better question. But, you know, tell that to Sam Alito and Anthony Scalia and John Roberts and well, we'll see how Kennedy goes on this. And who am I missing? Oh, Clarence Thomas, of course. How could I forget him?
I used to be a halfway decent religious person until these guys started. Now I want nothing to do with religion.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
They push us away.
I agree. My experience with many ways with Jerry Falwell and all that. Corky, thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Costa Mesa, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Direct TV system. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Where am I?
You are on the air, is where you are.
Yeah.
Are you
there?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I understand you have Marianne Williamson on.
Next.
And I was wondering how in the world she's going to reconcile her foo-foo ideas from Course in Miracles, which I love, and I like her too. But if she's going to go into the real world, they're going to tear her apart as being some little airy-fairy chick. And
well,
I don't know how she's going to handle it.
We will see. We will see. I will share your message, your question with her, and I believe Danielle is in the process of getting her on the line right now. So in about a minute and a half, she will be able to answer that. So say what? Oh, is it going to be at the bottom of the hour? Oh, okay. Actually, it'll be 14 minutes from now. So how much time do we have, Shane? 20 seconds. Okay. In that case, check out Abraham Lincoln's speech, June 26, 1857. Dear fellow citizens, I am here tonight partly by the invitation of some of you and partly by my own inclination. 2 weeks ago, Judge Douglas spoke here on the Dred Scott decision. Now, as to the Dred Scott decision, and then he goes on and on about this. He says, he quotes Andrew Jackson, actually. If the opinion of the Supreme Court covered the whole ground of this act, it ought not to control the coordinate authorities of this government. The Congress, the executive, and the court must each for itself be guided by its own opinion of the Constitution. Each public officer who takes an oath to support the Constitution swears that he will support it as he understands it, not as it is understood by others. Wow. This is amazing. In his speech about Dred Scott, Abraham Lincoln, who at that time was not yet president, says he quotes Andrew Jackson, president who was president, not at that moment, but I think Polk was president then, wasn't? No, Polk was earlier. Harrison, Pierce, I don't know whoever it was. Anyway, Abraham Lincoln quoting President Jackson on the power of the Supreme Court, saying that the Supreme Court, that for example, in the McCutcheon case today, the Supreme Court said that that Mr. McCutcheon, Sean McCutcheon, should be able to give, you know, up to $2,600 to as many politicians as he wants. Let him buy a million of them. And what the President of the United States should say, according to Phyllis Schlafly, and I'm really rapidly agreeing with her on this. It's fascinating having Phyllis Schlafly on the program earlier today talking about this. What the President of the United States should say is, fine, the Supreme Court has ruled that Sean McCutcheon has the right to buy as many politicians as he wants, but nobody else can. David Koch, Charles Koch, you can't do that. Sorry. It only applies to Sean McCutcheon because Congress makes the laws. Congress is elected by the people. I sign the laws. I'm elected by the people. Supreme Court is not elected by the people. They are the final court. So, and in that, in this speech that Abraham Lincoln gave in Springfield, Illinois, June 26, 1857, about Dred Scott, he quotes Andrew Jackson. He says, quote, "If the opinion of the Supreme Court covered the whole ground of this act," and he was talking actually about the bank, First National Bank of the United States, that Andrew Jackson, that the Supreme Court ruled was constitutional, and Andrew Jackson vetoed, saying it was unconstitutional. In fact, here's Lincoln talking about it. He says, "This same Supreme Court once decided a national bank to be constitutional, but General Jackson, as President of the United States, disregarded the decision and vetoed a bill for a recharter, partly on constitutional grounds, declaring that each public functionary must support the Constitution as he understands it." And then he says, but hear the general's own words. Here they are taken from his veto message. Quote, "If the opinion of the Supreme Court covered the whole ground of this act, it ought not to control the coordinate authorities of this government." In other words, the Supreme Court should not have the power to control the coordinate authorities are the House, the Senate, and the White House, the other two branches of government. So let me start over again. "If the opinion of the Supreme Court," this is Abraham Lincoln quoting President Jackson, quoting his veto, "if the opinion of the Supreme Court covered the whole ground of this act, it ought not to control the coordinate authorities of this government. The Congress, the executive, and the court must each for itself be guided by its own opinion of the Constitution. Each public officer who takes an oath to support the Constitution swears that he will support it as he understands it, and not as it is understood by others." End of quote. It's very interesting. He says, Abraham Lincoln then says, "I have said in substance that the Dred Scott decision was in part based on assumed historical facts, which are not really true. And I ought not to leave the subject without giving some reasons for saying this. I have therefore give an instance or two, which I think fully sustain me. Chief Justice Taney, in delivering the opinion of the majority of the court, insists at great length." He goes on. Well, I'm wandering into Wonkville here. Let me hold this for another time. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind today?
First of all, the question of the word money in the Constitution, it's there on the powers of Congress, but that's just a minor technicality for years. The word agreement's not there, but that's just my...
You're right. It says that Congress can appropriate money. You're right.
Talking about limiting the jurisdiction of courts, didn't they include that in the appropriations bill, H.R. 933, that organic farmers can no longer get court orders to protect their crops from GMOs? I think that was just passed. This year, I think they extended it.
Yeah, the Monsanto Protection Act. Yeah, in the budget.
So the right wing is into limiting the court frequently. If I may congratulate you on your global warming comments yesterday, although I think you should get in touch with your inner reptile. They seem to have.
Okay.
One other comment, if I may. If I had $5 trillion offshore in the islands of the Caribbean, I would be devoting 5% of it to crash our economy so I could pick up the rest for
pennies on the dollar.
Price.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's one of the points that we make in the crash of 2016. Some of the greatest fortunes in America were made during the Great Depression. There's a reason for that. Cash is absolutely king. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. Nate in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. Yeah, I'm just curious. Just you don't need to answer this, but my understanding is in the 26th Amendment, 18-year-olds have the right to vote. In the 19th Amendment, women have the right to vote. In the 15th Amendment, black men and women have the right to vote. But I'm curious where you have the right to vote.
It's not in there.
But
white men are not protected by the Constitution in their right to vote, and that was the essence of Bush v. Gore.
So why don't, in all these states, why don't we just say white men can't vote and let everyone else vote?
Well, you know, with regard to the white liberal colleges in North Carolina, that's what they're doing. I mean, they're and I believe that Scott Walker's trying to do the same thing in Wisconsin, is close down the polling places in colleges. You know, and in those who's the governor? Pat McCrory in North Carolina. He's shutting down the polling places in a historically black college, and they have, you know, both the 15th Amendment and the civil rights law that they can go back on him and say he's trying to get at us because we're black. But students in white colleges don't have that. And as the Supreme Court pointed out in Bush v. Gore, there is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution except for protected groups. And so we need, and the reason why, of course, was slavery. I mean, they didn't put it in the first place because of slavery. Nate, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's amazing how badly slavery warped this country. I mean, we have the Second Amendment because of slavery, so that the states could have slave patrols, for example. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. And today the McCutcheon case came down. The Supreme Court said, yes, Sean McCutcheon, you can buy as many politicians as you want. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing, you know, there's a fair number of politicians who have actually said, yeah, let's amend the Constitution, but let's carve out an exemption for, you know, my favorite group, a union or we had on this program last week, the group that Ralph Nader started. What's the name of it? I'm forgetting. In any case, we had them on, and they were like, "Well, you know, let's let nonprofit corporations still have rights as persons." And I'm like, "You know, you'll actually have more power if no corporation has rights of persons, because nonprofits and unions are membership organizations, and they can speak to their members, whereas corporations are not." But that's a whole other argument. But when I look at the field of candidates out there who are taking a very solid stand and building their candidacy on the idea that money is not found in the First Amendment, is not protected by the First Amendment as speech or as anything else, and B, that corporations are not found in the 14th Amendment. Lincoln didn't fight the Civil War to free the corporations. The 14th Amendment is clearly and unambiguously there to provide equal protection under the law to the slaves, to former slaves, is Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson is one of the few candidates in this country who is taking this kind of a position, and she is running for Henry Waxman's seat. He is retiring in California. It is the 33rd district of California, roughly Los Angeles area. Marianne Williamson is the author of 10 books, lecturer, thought leader, Marianne.com, MarianneForCongress.com, her websites. And Marianne, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It is great to have you on. First of all, first and foremost, I'm curious your thoughts on McCutcheon.
Well, I think it's a dark day for American democracy. This is like NAFTA on steroids, right? Yeah. I mean, Citizens United on steroids. And it's just like a nail in the coffin, another one. I mean, it's amazing. Somebody could spend up to over $5 million giving to PACs, giving to political parties. The only good I can see is that I think this will, it's an awakener. I think that there was a rumble about Citizens United, but with this one, I know because I've been, as you said, waging a campaign where, to me, this is, you know, this is the message I've been given, that the money in politics is the cancer underlying, you know, the issue underlying all other issues. It's the cancer eating our democracy, the nefarious effects of Citizens United. But I think the McCutcheon case and this decision takes it so far that it's obvious to anyone that the de-democratization of the United States of America, it's the goal here. This is what's going on here, right in front of us.
Turn us into an oligarchy, basically.
Absolutely, and we repudiated an aristocracy 200 years ago, and we're going to have to repudiate it again.
Yeah, well, and I would argue that we nearly repudiated it with the Progressive Revolution back in the 19-aughts, the 19-teens, and again with the New Deal. And, well, and arguably, again, with the Great Society. I mean, we keep trying, and we get a little bit of the way there, but it's like we really need to take this thing all the way. And good candidates like you can pull that off. Marianne, I mentioned a couple hours ago that you were going to be on the program, and somebody called in during one of the breaks about 20 minutes ago and said, would you please ask Marianne how she's going to deal with her being known as, and he said, an airy-fairy thought leader, a spiritual leader. He qualified it by saying, I love the Course in Miracles. But how do you reconcile that with politics? And I'm guessing you get that question a lot. I know that you've already addressed on this program before, but I see that, frankly, as an asset for you. But let me give you an opportunity to respond to that caller.
Well, I don't think anyone who has actually read my books or heard me lecture thinks that about me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a caricature drawn from people who, you know, like I said, they haven't read my books or they haven't heard me lecture. It's difficult to fight a caricature.
Right.
The truth of the matter is, you know, Martin Luther King said it was time to inject a new dimension of love into the veins of human civilization. No one called him a New Age woo-woo. I mean, you could pick some of the sentences from Mahatma Gandhi, from Martin Luther King, and they're all about, as Martin Luther King in describing Gandhi said, love as a broad-scale social force for good. So, you know, people say what they want to say, but the truth of the matter is I'm proud to be part of a larger conversation in this country that feels that politics should have a conscience, that love should be the bottom line in politics as well as everything else, that humanitarian values rather than economic values should be the guiding force in our civilization, and that this is not naive, that anybody who thinks that we can survive and thrive as a species for another 200 years, if we do not cultivate more brotherhood and justice, I think they're naive.
I think it's interesting that Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address in 1961, his famous military-industrial complex warning, added that the corrosive effect of the military-industrial complex included a spiritual corrosive element.
Absolutely, and I think he's correct, because what we have, as he predicted we would have if we did not rein in the military-industrial complex, is an entire economy that is a war economy, and this it is toxic to the soul that your primary orientation towards life is war. Your primary orientation towards life is fear. Your primary orientation towards life is defense. And that's not a naive statement. I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that, you know, there are people who genuinely hate us, and the idea that we would have a robust ability to respond to psychotic, you know, attacks, of course, I don't think we disagree. But what we have formed is an entire emotional and psychological constellation of attitudes that have to do with how to attack and how to defend, rather than a proactive cultivation of brotherhood and justice and peace.
Yeah. We're talking with Marianne Williamson. She is running for Henry Waxman's old seat in the 33rd District of California. The author of 10 books, lecturer and thought leader, Marianne.com, and MarianneForCongress.com, perhaps more importantly. And one of the most outspoken candidates in the country for getting money out of politics, and I think that this is a very, I've always thought that your candidacy was important and consequential, and this issue I think is the most important and consequential issue today, and could be, because as you correctly point out, it underlies everything else. It's the original cancer, and so glad to see that you're running. How's it going, Marianne?
Well, it's going very well. You know, people hear this message. And I think it's in the zeitgeist. And I think today with the McCutcheon case, you can really feel, you know, it's like this electricity in the air around people really waking up to this. So I think that the message that we need political heft, around this. You know, you were talking before about movetoamend.org. There's a lot going on outside Congress, but we can't leave electoral politics out of the formulation, particularly if you're talking about the, you know, preparing a constitutional amendment to send to the states for ratification. So I think people are open to the realization that it, in order for this new pro-democracy movement to have real political heft and have genuine force, it's going to have to be not just about people outside the electoral system. It's going to have to be that we run candidacies and we run winning campaigns. And I think people have a sober realization that this is true. I think that here in District 33 also, you know, L.A. prides itself. Los Angeles pride ourselves on the fact that we start new conversations here, and they become national trends within 5 years. And we need a new conversation in order to have a new America. It needs to start at that ground zero of realizing the de-democratization that is occurring because of the undue influence of money. And California can lay down the gauntlet. You know, we can lay down the gauntlet with this race, that people all over the country would know that LA actually sent an independent voice to Congress expressly on this issue of getting the money out of politics. And I think it would create a space around the country to inspire and motivate more candidates, because that's what we're going to need, Tom, obviously. It's not just one person in Congress. This is a whole huge movement. I feel that there is a real chance that District 33 of California will say, yeah, let's do this. Because if not our generation, then who? You know, if not when? If not now, then when? And I think many people see this particular election as an opportunity to do that.
And for those people who might want to go to MarianneForCongress.com and pitch in or help out or you know, whether they're in the 33rd district or not, let's explain the process. California has a top two primary system. Can you tell us how that works and when it's happening?
Yes. What we have in California is an open primary in which instead of voting in the Democratic primary or Republican primary, everybody in the state gets the same ballot. You know, everybody in the district would get the same ballot. And then instead of somebody winning the Republican primary and somebody else winning the Democratic primary, et cetera, whoever the top two vote getters are on June 3rd, our primary date, then goes to the general election in November. So it could be two Democrats, a Democrat and a Republican, a Democrat and an Independent, an Independent and a Republican, whoever the top two vote getters are on June 3rd. And people have to be registered by May 19th. So it's a big deal. And any support that anyone feels like sending our way is deeply appreciated and I think will be well used because we'll do everything possible to slam this election and win the primary.
Yeah, and this is a system actually that favors, you know, that doesn't disfavor independent candidates like most others do. And you, like Bernie Sanders, are running as an independent.
Absolutely, like Bernie Sanders. And if I win, I will be in the House like Bernie Sanders, independent in the House like Bernie Sanders is in the Senate.
And may you carry on his tradition. MarianneWilliamson, MarianneForCongress.com is the website. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the great work. I am so pleased that you are doing this.
God bless
you.
So pleased. I'm so grateful to you.
Thank you, Marianne. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Once again, that's Marianne, M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E, for F-O-R, Congress.com. Check it out. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bob in Allendale, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind? Bob? Oh, don't tell me our phones have croaked again. Bob, if you're listening, let's see, which line is he calling in on? He's calling in on line 3, which is the...
Hello?
Oh, Bob, there you are. Okay. So you were listening to your radio instead of your phone. So what's up, Bob?
Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. You're on the air.
I just had a reaction to this concept of amending the Constitution.
Yes.
In reaction to, I guess, Citizens United and McCutcheon case.
Well, it's not just that. It goes all the way back to Buckley and... Before that, even. Yeah.
But there seems to me to be a more fundamental problem with the Supreme Court. If you look at the Constitution, it was never really, in its initial phases, viewed as a democratic government. It was limited to democratic government. And over the years, the presidency and the election laws and the Congress and the amendment to directly elect the Senate made the Constitution, the people essentially made the Constitution more democratic.
Small D Democratic, correct.
But the big exception to that has been the Supreme Court. So the Constitution, as was originally conceived, was an insider's ball game. And through sheer force of will, the people sort of took it back for themselves.
Right.
But not the Constitution, not the Supreme Court, which I think is the fundamental problem. Like, if you look at history, the Supreme Court makes a decision, and then we have to reverse it. On and on and on. So in addition to sort of fixing individual Supreme Court judgments, I think what we've got to do is try and fix the Supreme Court, make it more democratic.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And this is something that Congress could do if they had the will to do it under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. And an hour and a half or 2 hours ago, we had Phyllis Schlafly on this program, of all people. She actually has written a book on this. And she points out that Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court operates under the exceptions and regulations defined by Congress. So Congress can pass a law saying that the Supreme Court, it may not rule on cases that have to do with campaign financing. And that becomes the law under which the Supreme Court has to operate. And it's right there in the Constitution. Now, the Supreme Court could overturn that and say, we're going to reject this. But that doesn't mean that the president has to accept that. It doesn't mean that Congress has to accept that. And she said that, basically with regard to, for example, McCutcheon, that what Obama should say and Congress should back him up on this is, well, OK, the Supreme Court said she cited Abraham Lincoln. What Abraham Lincoln said when Dred Scott came down was that what the position of President Buchanan should be at that time in 1856 should be, OK, Mr. Scott, very sorry, the Supreme Court has ruled that you are the property of Mr. Sanford. But that doesn't mean that all the states have to go slave states. That doesn't mean that it applies to anybody else. And similarly, Obama today could say, OK, Sean McCutcheon, you get to buy as many politicians as you want. The Supreme Court just said so. But that doesn't mean that anybody else gets to. The people in this country make the laws, not the Supreme Court. And I was quoting at some length from Abraham Lincoln's statement during, his debates with Stephen Douglas on the Dred Scott decision, where he was basically saying that. And he was quoting Andrew Jackson, who said that each branch of government should decide for itself what is constitutional. If the Supreme Court weighs in, then the House, the Senate, and the executive branch, the president, all get to have their decision, too. And we have decided now to give it all to the Supreme Court. And that's just wrong. Bob, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Tom Harmon here with you. Welcome back. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on you? You wanted to talk about Hobby Lobby?
Well, I've been listening to, and of course I know about McCutcheon, but I don't think that people are thinking about the future. If this Hobby law is passed, saying that it's against their religion to provide these birth control things, how many other companies will come up and say the same thing?
Right.
Well, how about a company that says they don't believe in hiring women, that women should stay home? Or a company that says...
And there are actually groups that assert that, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, there are some Christian groups, I don't know what the Mormon Church's position is on this now, but it used to be that, et cetera.
Well, also, how about people who believe in separation? The Lord separated people after the Tower of Babel. Is that true? I'm not a good Bible.
Yeah,
leader.
I mean that's the yeah. That's
so
that's,
they don't want to hire people of color.
Right.
This can attack not just women's rights, but civil rights and equal employment opportunity rights.
Yes, that argument was made before the Supreme Court, and Justice Roberts' response to it was, "Well, maybe we could narrowly decide this just with regard to Hobby Lobby." And
these people will go back to the well.
Oh, I know. And go ahead.
I'm gonna change the topic on you real quick.
Okay.
They're passing laws here that's gonna make it impossible to have wind towers here.
In Alabama?
Yes.
Wow.
And they've changed the when you can register to vote, when you can sign up to run for office, and nobody isn't paying any attention.
Yeah, I'm so with you, Norma. And these are very, very seminal issues that we should be paying attention to. But our media doesn't pay attention to them either, because our media is owned by the same companies that own basically the politicians who are doing this kind of stuff. Norma, thank you for the call. Excellent points. William in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, William, what's up?
Well, good afternoon. I wanted to respond because what we're doing in San Luis Obispo is something I actually was hoping to talk to you about at some point anyway. We're holding the very first national gathering of the leading voices of campaign finance reform on June 2nd to the 5th here in San Luis Obispo. And we've got Professor, former Secretary of Labor, Professor Robert Reich, Trevor Potter, Professor Lawrence Lessig, Common Cause, Move to Amend, a lot of the big organizations, because one of the things that we found is there are 11 different amendments out there proposed to the Constitution between the two houses of Congress, and there's a number of different pieces of legislation, but there's no real national strategy. There's no real national unity to this effort.
Right.
So what we're trying to do, and we would really look for support from people out there, to go to our website. May I give that?
Sure.
Our website is citizenscongress2014.org.
Okay.
And on the website, what we're trying to do is to try to get people to understand that this is a backyard issue. When you talk to most people about campaign finance reform, the eyes roll at the back of their heads. They really haven't figured out how to make this a NIMBY issue, for people to understand that this affects their daily lives, every aspect of their daily lives.
Right.
And we've got to do better about messaging that. We've got to figure out what our national strategy is and the steps to get to these goals. And most likely it's a plural approach. You're not going to get one amendment that's going to cover all these bases. You're not going to get one piece of legislation that covers all these bases.
Yep.
You're going to need to create a safety net for our representatives or for our candidates like Ms. Williamson so that they know that they don't necessarily have to go to large donors. When it costs $1.5 million to run a successful, on average, candidacy for Congress or $11.5 million for Senate, it makes it exceedingly difficult for people to have a higher ethical standard unless we show them there's a safety net there to support them.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with you, William, and I congratulate you on what you're doing, assuming it is as you represent it. And hopefully a lot of people will go to your website. What was the website again?
It's called Citizens Congress. So it's www.citizenscongress2014.org. We have a video on there.
Okay.
People can register to the Congress, and they can see what we're doing. It's meant to be a gathering, a roundtable, United
Great.
Nations.
No, I got it. I got it. You already said that. Thank you very much for the call, and good luck with it. Jerry in Long Island, listening to WBAI. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Yeah, I'd like to talk about the Citizens United case and also the McCutcheon case, too, since that came up today. I can combine my comments to comment on both of them and the whole issue of getting money out of politics. Now, obviously, I think let me preface my remarks by first pointing out that obviously I think both of these decisions are terrible. The majority opinion in both McCutcheon and Citizens United is terrible. And I think I think most of us want to get money out of politics. But I think the problem with a constitutional amendment like the one Mr. Cobb is proposing that simply says money is not speech and that corporations are not people is that such a proposed constitutional amendment, I think, fails to take into consideration that there are at least four conservative, and I would argue also corporate Republicans on this nation's highest court, who are predisposed to rule in favor of having both corporations and wealthy individuals having the right to pour as much money as they want into our political system.
Right, but they have to do it within the constraints of the Constitution. So if you amend the Constitution...
But they'll use another... If they're unable to use First and 14th Amendment arguments to get them the result that they want, they'll simply use other legal arguments. And that's why I think that we have to... use other legal arguments to come up with a pro-corporate ruling on campaign spending. And that's why I think we need a constitutional amendment that clearly and specifically makes both campaign spending limits and lobbying reform a basic constitutional right, a basic fundamental right of we the people. And I think we should have language that says something in effect that it's the right of the people to have federal, state, and or local governments impose campaign spending or campaign finance limits or lobbying restrictions on individuals, corporations, or other entities, and that right shall not be abridged or denied in any way whatsoever.
Jerry, I strongly recommend you get over to movetoamend.org and start that conversation with David Cobb and the other great folks there. It's an interesting concept. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to WBAI. Coming up tomorrow, a new Pew Research study says the Christian right is responsible for the decline of religion in America. I'll be challenging Brian Fisher of the American Family Association on that. Plus, one of my favorite segments of the week, Geeky Science, together with your calls. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does begin with you. MarianneForCongress.com and MoveToAmend.org. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.